the U.S. housing market, blooming, if not booming. From APM, I'm Jeff Horwich. Hello, everybody. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, September 19th. A little later, we'll talk about the implications of the end of the school strike for now in Chicago. And we'll talk about Groupon announcing this morning that it is getting into the mobile payments game. But first, U.S. existing home sales in August hit the highest level in more than 2 years, up almost 8%. Also, some new data this morning, home builders started 750,000 houses last month across the country. That's the seasonally adjusted number. That's up more than 2% from the month before, up almost 30% from a year ago. So definitely the right direction, but how strong is this housing recovery that we're seeing? For more, David Kelly is here. He's chief global strategist for JP Morgan Funds. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
This morning's housing data, what do you think?
Well, it wasn't quite as strong on the headline number as we'd hoped for, but within those numbers, you got to look at single-family housing starts, and they went up by 5.5%. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a lot more construction activity in a single-family home than in a multifamily unit. So overall, I think it's reasonably strong, and it supports other numbers we're seeing on housing. In general, this is a year of a housing recovery.
So we have housing and we have employment, these twin fronts of economic recovery. If we're starting to have housing, what's it mean for jobs?
Well, I think it will eventually help jobs. Now, the housing sector overall is quite small in the U.S. economy, but the nice thing about a recovery in housing, particularly a recovery in housing prices, is it does a lot of good things at the same time. If home prices go up, it helps consumer confidence, it encourages builders to build, it increases household wealth, and actually encourages banks to lend also because they're less worried about their mortgage portfolios. So overall, we think this recovery in housing is one of the things that's really supporting the U.S. economy right now.
Before I let you go, we've also got news today of a big new quantitative easing style plan from the Bank of Japan. You know, when our own Fed makes a move like that, as it did last week, markets everywhere respond positively. Should we make much of it when Japan has a go?
I don't think so. I mean, I think markets ought to go up because what's really going on is central banks are removing tail risks. They're removing the risk of disaster. They're saying they're very active. If something really bad happens, they'll be there. And I think that's mm-hmm. positive, whether it's Japan or the European Central Bank or the U.S. Federal Reserve. But ultimately, the long history of what the Japanese Central Bank has been doing to try and help their economy, it really doesn't work. I mean, you need the economy to grow itself in a way. Trying to increase credit when interest rates are so low anyway doesn't really help an economy grow.
David Kelly with JP Morgan Funds. Thank you.
Anytime.
All right, let's do the numbers. Well, the morning started out kind of quiet and flat on Wall Street, but it's turning positive. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 Index both up about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up just a bit, about 0.1%. American Airlines is warning about 11,000 workers of possible job losses. The company is going through a bankruptcy restructuring right now. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal this morning took an interesting look at Americans' flight performance for the first few days this week, and it doesn't look too good. A third to half of flights are arriving late this week. As it turns out, American is phasing in new work rules that its pilots don't like very much. The pilots' union denies that its members are engaging in a work slowdown. Back to school today in Chicago. In the next couple weeks, teachers will vote on the tentative contract deal reached between the union and negotiators for the school district and Mayor Rahm Emanuel. So to do a little post-game analysis on all that, Kate Walsh is here. She's president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. Good morning.
Hello.
So, Kate, call it like you see it. Who won this thing?
All in all, I'd say the district won. And the district may have won before it even got started in some respects because all in all, I would say the district got most of what it was asking for.
And the teachers lost? Did they lose in a big way, you think?
Well, it depends on your view of what it is to lose. I think the union may feel like it didn't get what it was asking for. Teachers, in the long run, won't lose.
Nationally now, is Chicago a prelude? Is this all coming to a city near us?
There were a lot of things going on in Chicago that aren't going on in other districts. We had months of building up to the strike. Chicago had the shortest school day of the large urban districts in the country. So I don't think we're going to see similar action in other districts just because there were more issues at play here.
But this critical issue about teacher pay tied to performance, that's everywhere.
Well, this doesn't really introduce the notion of performance pay. This introduces the idea that teachers will be judged in part on how well their children do on standardized tests. The fact that the district came out at 30% of the tests counting towards a teacher's evaluation when it started at 50. We don't know what the right amount is, so it's not clear whether the district really gave a lot.
I am curious about the politics of it. This was a Democratic mayor taking on the teachers' unions, and that's new. What do you take away from it?
I think that's the most significant takeaway from the strike. And so you're seeing more and more big city Democratic mayors who are saying, you know, I believe in teachers' unions. I don't happen to agree with your positions on this or that issue. And I think we're seeing big movement in that direction.
President of the National Council on Teacher Quality, Kate Walsh, thank you.
Thank you.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
If you're not intimately familiar with the term mobile payments, well, get ready to start hearing it a lot more. Basically, it means paying for something with a smartphone. Right now, some of the big players are Google and a company called Square. But today there's news Groupon. They of the Daily Deal fame. Well, Groupon is getting in on mobile payments as well. Marketplace's technology reporter, Quina Kim, is here with me. Hey, Quina.
Hey.
So first of all, what's the tech here that Groupon plans to put out there?
So basically what they're doing is they're offering retailers and small merchants, the ability to process credit cards on their iPhone. So one of the devices that they're offering is you sort of just plug something into an iPhone, and then you can swipe your credit card on it.
Sure.
And it'll process the payment for you. And I guess the idea of this is that sometimes, you know, the traditional credit card companies are a little bit out of reach for small mom-and-pop retailers. And this has just sort of expanded that base and has made credit card payments more accessible.
Now, most of the news that we've reported about Groupon lately has been not so good, right? Why would they want to get into this?
Well, Groupon's been having a little bit of a hard time lately. When it went public in November, I think it closed that day at $26. And when I last checked, it was at $6. And the big problem they're having is they're not growing as quickly as investors had wanted them to do. So I think their last earnings, their revenues were actually below analyst expectations. So they're not bringing in the money. So this is a way to bring in the money.
So Groupon must think the mobile payments space, as we say in the business world, is going to be big. How big a deal do you think it's going to be?
Well, this is the big battleground right now with all the big companies. The dominant player right now is Square, and they're saying that they're going to process something like $8 billion worth of payments this year. So mm-hmm. If that gives you any idea, it's already a pretty big space. Google's getting into it. I think everybody feels like it's just a matter of time before Apple gets into it. So I think it's the next battleground.
And the one scenario that is sort of the ultimate here that I've heard about is like you walk into a coffee shop, your phone's in your pocket, you get your coffee, you don't even have to take the phone out of your pocket to pay. That does sound cool.
Yeah, and that's what Square is going to be offering. And so it sort of begs the question, Groupon's a little bit of a Johnny-come-lately to this game. You know, Square has done the mobile payments, and they're actually innovating and moving forward. And plus, they're super well-funded. So it'll be interesting to see how this fight pans out.
Marketplace's Quina Kim, thanks a lot.
Great, thank you.
Russia is accusing the United States of using its aid mission in Moscow to interfere with Russian politics. The Russian government says the USAID mission must close down by October. That's after 20 years of offering assistance there. Earlier today, my Morning Report colleague Jeremy Hobson talked to the BBC's Steve Rosenberg, who is in Moscow. And here's Jeremy.
So why are the Russians demanding an end to U.S. aid programs all of a sudden?
Well, the fact is that the Russian authorities have grown increasingly suspicious of non-governmental organizations which receive foreign funding. The Russians accused the U.S. aid mission of trying to influence political processes in Russia, including elections and institutions of civil society. And that gets to the crux of it, because there are a lot of people in power in Russia today who believe that the United States has been using grants to NGOs in Russia as a way of influencing what happens here, the political situation, and even to spark revolution.
Well, is that true? I mean, what has the money been used for, and what has USAID been doing there in Moscow?
Well, there's been a lot of money. In fact, USAID has spent more than $2 billion over the last 20 years on a whole range of aid programs, like fighting disease, tuberculosis, AIDS, to protect the environment. But most controversially, to try and build a civil society. So there are lots of programs to develop democratic institutions, civil society institutions, supporting human rights. And that is what the Russian authorities don't like.
What does this mean for U.S.-Russian relations?
Well, U.S.-Russian relations have been growing steadily worse over the recent months. Relations are not good, and that's not going to get any better, certainly not before the U.S. presidential election.
The BBC Steve Rosenberg in Moscow, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
And finally, as if a Kentucky woman wasn't in enough trouble for her DUI, she's in even more hot water because of her Facebook page. Louisville's NBC station says after the woman's hit-and-run incident left four teenagers injured, she posted rather cavalierly about it on her Facebook page. Got a DUI and I hit a car. LOL. Yeah. So, in addition to her initial sentence, the judge ordered her to delete her Facebook account. She did not do that. Civil liberties groups note it's not clear if the First Amendment might protect a Facebook account in a situation like this, but for now, she has earned another 2 days behind bars. In court, she was apologetic, but she was a little surprised. Quote, "I didn't think LOL would put me in jail." That's all for today. I'm Jeff Horwich. You've been listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.